It's Sunday afternoon and time once again for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and you're listening, of course, to Asheville FM. And you know that already because you're there on the website. And joining me today, once again, North Carolina's very own poet laureate, Kathy Smith Bowers. Hello, Kathy. How are you?
Hello, Jeff Davis. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing just hunky-dory. Yeah. Wonderful day.
Well, it's wonderful to be here once again.
Yeah. Well, it's great to have you here. Who have you got with you today?
Well, before I introduce our guest, I want to first thank you, Jeff Davis, and the North Carolina Department of Cultural Resources for making this Laureate's Hour possible. And my goal on every third Sunday of the month is to shine a light on the amazing literary talent throughout the state of North Carolina. Today, I'm very excited to shine that light on one of my favorite poets, William Matthews, who died suddenly as he was just turning 55 in 1997, I believe. But today's light will also shine on another of my favorites, his son, Sebastian Matthews. Sebastian lives here in Asheville with his wife, Allie, and his son, who is probably the most adorable child who ever walked the face of the earth.
He thinks so.
Right,
yeah.
Sebastian?
Yeah, I agree.
Avery, who is just now 7. Sebastian teaches at Warren Wilson College and in the Low Residency MFA program at Queen's University of Charlotte. He is the editor of the literary journal Rivendell, the author of a memoir, In My Father's Footsteps, and a book of poems, We Generous. Welcome, Sebastian. Oh. Welcome.
Thank you, Kathy. It's great to be here. I didn't realize, and I'm excited to be part of the Laureate Hour. That's awesome.
Well, it's exciting to me to shine a light on two at one time.
Well,
and I'm already nervous that there's so much light that needs to be shown on you and your dad, and we don't have as much time, so we'll just have to have you back.
If you buy quickly, you get Ginzu knives as well.
Sebastian, one of the things we're going to talk about tonight is your, I think, just beautifully written memoir, In My Father's Footsteps. Very early in that memoir, after finding out your father has just died, you reminisce about one of your father's parties. And I remember when I first read this book, shortly after it came out, how amazed I was at how you captured in that passage, in that description, your father's charismatic presence. Would you read some of that passage for us?
Sure. Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm going to start a paragraph above the one that you pointed to, I think because it sets it up, but also because for me, writing about his death was writing about his apartment. That was a kind of breakthrough for me. His apartment and his personality were very similar. Mm-hmm. They one informed the other. So, when a pigeon flew up past the window, its shadow slithering over the red brick buildings across the way, a melody started playing in my head, one of those slow-starting monk compositions that winds itself up like a hand-cranked record player. The first melody was followed by other fragments of song, my little snippets of music I'd listened to in this room over the years, Cuts Off Miles' Kind of Blue, Marley's Chanting on Babylon by Bus, The Anguished Cry in Rigoletto, A Running Rush in a Mozart Sonata, the opening climb of Bach's first cello suite, Dylan's You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go. And then I was lost, back up at all the dinner parties my father held for his literati friends, elegant people milling about, bottles of wine opened and emptied in a spontaneous toast of glasses, my father holding court in the center of a small group, wine glass in hand, left leg splayed out in front of him, right wrist curled back against his waist, elbow out, leaning back a little, eyes sparkling, he surveyed his audience before letting loose his trademark wit. It was as though he was surfing. The board he crouched on was his sharp mind, the wave, the tumult of words forming inside him. People were leaning in, either curious bystander or comrade in the know. And a pretty young woman had moved intently into my father's sphere, placing her hand on his arm. She was looking up at him, wanting to know everything she could about this man.
Wow. You know, Sebastian, I never had the privilege of going to one of your dad's parties. However, I had the honor
of... I'm surprised.
Little South Carolina girl.
Yeah.
he didn't want to make his friends experience such shock and awe by having me there.
He might have passed that.
I did have the honor of teaching with him at a few conferences. Yeah. And there was something about him, and it was certainly not an in-your-face charisma at all. As a matter of fact, you know, I found him rather quiet. Yeah. And yet, you know, if he sat in the corner of a room,
yeah,
everybody would migrate, yeah, toward him. Everybody wanted to be around and, yeah, as close to your dad as they could get.
Yeah, he was amazing. And I think of, like, the idea of the best comics, or not the best comics, but a lot of the comics seem to be shy, quiet people.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then they kind,
yeah,
of, and I don't say he was always on, but I think when he was at a conference, I think he knew he was kind of always on. Mm-hmm. So if he just sat back, well, whatever would come would come. And he was a good storyteller and a good,
that's yeah, all he had to do. It, yeah, was just absolutely amazing. Yeah. Jeff, what are your memories of Bill?
Well, I actually did go to one of Bill's parties. That's where I met Sebastian when he was like 3 years old.
I was already drinking back then. I was kind of, yeah, intense. Yeah. Yeah. I was in my cups. These are literal terms.
But yeah, Bill was he had a real charm and a formidable intelligence. He was a great mentor. I mean, to me, he was only a couple of years older, I guess, than I was. But yeah, knew so much more about poetry. He was a fantastic guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, even his poems are like that, too. They're not in your face, and yet he had the most brilliant way of making you look at something in a way that you had never, yeah, thought of it,
yeah,
before.
Or
that,
hear
that
something.
Wit,
or, yeah. It
was
special,
just absolutely,
yeah,
amazing.
He had a special authority, I guess.
Yeah.
Was, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That he could evoke. Yeah, it
was, well, he didn't, you know, just as he was in life, he didn't have to be in your face,
yeah,
for that intelligence, that brilliance to come through. So I absolutely loved his poems, and I still pull them out every so often.
Yeah, so do I.
Well, as far as the memoir, and I find it just wonderful all the way through, and I highly recommend those of you who have not read In My Father's Footsteps, get a copy of it.
And I'd say don't, you know. but that's just me.
Is it still in print?
Yeah.
Still in print.
It's the beautiful glory of On Demand. It's now a paperback.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Very excited. Not like it was a legitimate paperback, but
yeah,
it's you can get it, and it's paperback. Uh-huh. It's amazing.
What surprises did you have, Sebastian, as you were writing that memoir?
Oh, that I was doing it. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was hard to do. But I took I took memoir seriously. I think people don't always, as a literary form, and I was very intimidated by it. So I read a lot, you know. I saw that there was a technique that people were using, a kind of trick, just like confessing early on what you really wanted to talk about, and
yeah,
then just talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that, and of course I talked myself into areas that were like hard.
Mm.
But I'm glad I did it, and now I teach memoir avidly, because I think I know how to teach ways for people to approach their own stories. Mm-hmm. And it's really wild to see them do it, because it's, mm-hmm, there's so many stories out there. You know, for me, my story was about my relationship to my dad, and I realized to my wife, to Allie, and to, mm-hmm, you know, and the connections through all the connections that you get through father and son, good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you get this genetic thing, or you, this, you know, or it's not always genetic, you just get this thing, love pattern thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you kind of start to grow up, and you realize you're a lot like your dad, or, mm-hmm, or the ways that you're not. And,
mm-hmm,
so,
well, you certainly did do a powerful job of that, and made yourself vulnerable in a, yep, lot of ways, and yet, you know, still maintained a kind of objectivity that I thought that was very effective. Very effective.
Well, thank you. You know, I mean, it's a first book, you know, but it's the objectivity. I mean, you know, the memoir is not a reportage. You know, mm-hmm, you're not gonna lie, hopefully, but you're gonna miss the truth sometimes, and you're gonna color it a certain way, because it's this first person eye is gonna, mm-hmm, do that. So I just kind of went for it, and it was a great experience, but I will never do it again.
Whoa. Do you have any other, what are your favorite passages? Would you like to read other passages for us?
Yeah, I can read you one. Maybe I'll try to read one that I haven't. Let me see. Ask me another question, and I'll flip while I'm talking.
Okay.
Or talk while I'm flipping. I'm not sure which. I can do both.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Listen, Jeff, ask him a question.
Well, that was a good move.
It's your radio show. Yeah. You ask him. Yeah.
That was good. That was like, you know.
Well, let's see. I guess you've already seen signs of little Avery. Avery, you certainly have that charisma, Sebastian, and I'm sure that, you know, I met Avery when he was 5, I think, and I could tell that
he's got it. Yeah, he's got it. He's his own guy. He's sharp.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And he's.
Didn't you say he already has a 10-year-old who's sort of interested in him?
Oh yeah, I mean, he falls in love as a good, you know, 7-year-old will with all the cool boys and girls who will show him tricks. You know,
right.
He wants to. He's going up the ladder quickly. He wants to, you know. So, but he's great. I'm going to read one about my father's apartment in New York City before the one that he moved into. Mm-hmm. So this is one that he had a couple temporary ones. He was in the Stuyvesant for a while, which was just, oh, God, and depressing. And it was also, he was also up on 106th in the West Side, and then he moved up to the 121st. Mm-hmm. So this is just a short passage about one of his poems and that apartment. My father's first apartment in New York City was this depressing little shithole lost in the verticality of a Stuyvesant high-rise. I can say shit, right?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Okay. It was a gray, boxy thing with little or no light. Not a fit place to wash a rat in, as Nora Joyce once said of James's flat. He stayed there a year until he got a temporary place on West 106, also known as Duke Ellington Boulevard. He liked to point out, one of those shotgun apartments that ran back in a train of rooms. You had to walk through one to get to the next. Because the floors slanted and because there was always something rattling in the building or somebody pounding on the walls, there were times when it felt like you were on a moving train. My father sets a poem in that first Upper West Side apartment. It's called Little Blue Nude. In it, the speaker, and here I picture my father raising an eyebrow, an ironic smile spreading down his face from eyes to pursed lips, has just been robbed. What makes matters worse is he knows who did it, and as the poem spills itself out in controlled confession, exactly how and why. And this is from the poem. The mere pressure of my key on the lock, before I'd even turned it, swung my door open, and my body knew he'd come in through the kitchen, but left like a guest by the front door. And the next line is, Tony, my dumpster-diving neighbor. And he starts talking about how he let Tony into his house all the time and bought, like, stolen goods from him because it was like convenient. And helped his girlfriend out, and then maybe saw that she got her eye punched. So suddenly Tony's like, I don't like you very much.
Yeah.
and then he realizes he's complicit.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, Then he gets pissed off, but can't do anything about it, like a good poet.
Yeah.
Let's listen to a little Charles Mingus.
Speaking of pissed off.
Thank you.
And a little Charles Mingus there. Yeah, that's from his wonderful CD, East Coast to Him. With Bill Evans,
with
right.
Bill Evans,
that's yeah. right. Yeah, yeah, that's right. And of course, Bill Evans was the musician we heard on the way into the show. His Waltz for Debbie, fantastic tune. Yeah, yeah. Well, Sebastian, your dad actually produced some audio when he was, mid career, as it were, back in the '80s.
Yeah, I remember when it first came out. We were talking about it on listening to the music. There was a cassette, and it had like a Snow Leopard on it, I think, and it was like a sepia-toned photograph, and it had my dad's picture on the back, and I was just like, oh, man, maybe he really, maybe he really is a serious, whatever that is, because I was a teenager, so it's kind of, but
right.
I was very proud of it. I liked it.
Maybe he really is a poet.
Yeah. Yeah. His feet show it.
Here's evidence.
Yeah. Not every poet had a cassette out in those days.
Too many.
Yeah.
It was cool.
Gary Snyder, Robert Bly, and Bill Matthews.
They were always, though he's not known, it's so funny how like the Deep Image poets and those guys are separated. But back, in the 70s, it seemed like they were all hanging out in the same journals and publishing each other. And Stephen Mooney here in Tennessee. And so I kind of wonder why that's been separated out, why Bly and Wright and are over here and Snyder's over here. They seem very close. I know they went different ways, but
right.
Yeah.
So
anyway. But you're right. They were all publishing the same places.
Totally.
Yeah. 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 Like Little Arrow.
Yeah. Yeah. William Stafford.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Just old boy, You publish me, I'll publish you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, at least they were good.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Yeah. And they were beautifully made.
Well, I'm just really excited that we have these tapes of Bill Matthews reading his poems.
Yeah. Like 70, I think, or is it 70, or is it later? No, this is like 80.
This is 84.
Bolder, yeah.
So this is tracks from Days Beyond Recall.
Spring snow. Here comes the powdered milk I drank as a child, and the money it saved. Here come the papers I delivered, the spotted dog in heat that followed me home, and the dogs that followed her. Here comes a load of white laundry from basketball practice, and sheets with their watermarks of semen. And here comes snow, a language in which no word is ever repeated. Love is impossible and remorse. Yet childhood doesn't end, but accumulates, each memory knit to the next, and the fields become one field. If to die is to lose all detail, then death is not so distinguished, but a profusion of detail, a last gossip, character passed wholly into fate, and fate in flecks like dust, like flower, like snow. This poem called Living Among the Dead bears an epigraph from the French poet Paul Éluard, who wrote, "There is another world, but it is in this one." First there were those who died before I was born. It was as if they had just left, and their shadows would slip out after them under the door so recently closed the air and its path was still swirling to rest. Some of the furniture came from them, I was told, and one day I opened two chests of drawers to learn what the dead kept. But it was when I learned to read that I began always to live among the dead. I remember Rapunzel, the improved animals in the just-so stories, and a flock of birds that saved themselves from a hunter by flying in place in the shape of a tree, their wings imitating the whisk of wind in the leaves. My sons and I are like some wine the dead have already bottled. They wish us well, but there is nothing they can do for us. Sebastian cries in his sleep. I bring him into my bed, talk to him, rub his back. To help his sons live easily among the dead is a father's great work. Now Sebastian drifts, soon he'll sleep. We can almost hear the dead breathing. They sound like water under a ship at sea. To love the dead is easy. They are final, perfect. But to love a child is sometimes to fail at love, while the dead look on with their abstract sorrow. To love a child is to turn away from the patient dead. It is to sleep carefully in case he cries. Later, when my sons are grown among their own dead, I can dive easily into sleep and loll among the coral of my dreams, growing on themselves, until at the end I almost never dream of anyone except my sons, who is still alive. Moving again. At night, the mountains look like huge, dim hens. In a few geological eras, new mountains may shatter the Earth's shell and poke up like stone wings. Each part must serve for a whole. I bring my sons to the base of the foothills, and we go up. From a scruff of ponderosa pines, we startle gaudy swerves of magpies that settle in our rising wake. Then there's a blooming prickly pear. "Jesus, Dad, what's that?" Willie asks. "It's like a yellow tulip grafted to a cactus. It's a beautiful wound the cactus puts out to bear fruit and be healed. If I lived with my sons all year, I'd be less sentimental about them." We go up to the mesa top and look down at our new hometown. The thin air warps in the melting light like the aura before a migraine. The boys are tired. A tiny magpie fluffs into a pine far below, and farther down in the valley of child support and lights, people are opening drawers. One of them finds a yellowing patch of newsprint with a phone number penciled on it from Illinois. From before they moved, before Nikki was born. Memory is our root system. "Verna," he says to himself, because his wife's in another room, "whose number do you suppose this is?" Photo of the author with a favorite pig. Behind its snout, like a huge button, like an almost clean plate, the pig looks candid compared to the author. And why not? He has a way with words, but the unspeakable pig, squat and four square as a bathtub, squints frankly. Nobody knows the trouble it's seen, this rained-out pig roast, this ham escaped into its corpulent jokes, its body of work. The author is skinny and looks serious, as if wondering what to say to the pig, which is fat and looks funny, as if it knows but can't say. Search party. I wondered if the others felt as heroic and as safe. My unmangled family slept while I slid uncertain feet ahead behind my flashlight's beam. Stones, thick roots as twisted as a ruined body. What did I fear? I hoped my batteries had 8 more lives than the lost child. I feared I'd find something. Reader, by now you must be sure you know just where we are. Deep in symbolic woods, irony, self-accusation, someone else's suffering, the search is that of art. You're wrong, though it's an intelligent mistake. There was a real lost child. I don't want to swaddle it in metaphor. I'm just a journalist who can't believe in objectivity. I'm in these poems because I'm in my life, but I digress. A man 4 volunteers to the left of me made the discovery. We circled in like waves returning to the parent shock. You've read this far. You might as well have been there, too. Your eyes accuse me of false chase. Come off it. You're the one who thought it wouldn't matter what we found. Though we came with lights and tongues thick in our heads, the issue was a human life. The child was still alive. Admit you're glad. This poem is called Whiplash. It contains, about a third of its way through, the name of a punctuation mark. That punctuation mark is a question mark and an exclamation point printed together. And apparently they have no better name in this life than the word interrobang. So when I get to the word interrobang in the poem, you'll know what that means. Whiplash. That month he was broke. So when the brakes to his car went sloshy, he let them go. Next month, his mother came to visit, and out they went to gawk, to shop, to have something to do while they talked, besides sitting down like a seminar to talk. One day soon, he'd fix the brakes, or, as he joked after nearly bashing a cab and skidding Widdershins through the intersection of Viewcrest and Edgecliff, they'd fix him one of these oncoming days. We like to explain our lives to ourselves. So many of our fictions are about causality. Chess problems where the interrobang after White's 16th move marks the beginning of disaster. Insurance policies, box scores, psychotherapy, were your needs being met in this relationship? Reader's guides to pity and to terror. And about the possibility that because aging is relentless, logic, too, runs straight and one way only. By this hope to know how our disasters almost shatter us, it would make sense to say the accident he drove into the day after his mother left began the month he was broke. Though why was he broke? Because of decisions he'd made the month before to balance decisions the month before that. And so on, all the way back to birth and beyond, for his mother and father brought to his life the luck of theirs. And so when his car one slick day oversped its dwindling ability to stop itself and smacked two parked cars and lightly kissed another like a satisfying billiards shot. And all this action, so slow in compression and preparation, exploded so quickly. It seemed not that his whole life swam or skidded before him, but that his whole life was behind him, like a physical force, the way a dinosaur's body was behind its brain. And the news surged up and down its vast and clumsy spine like an early version of the blues. Indeed, indeed, what might he do but sing, as if to remind himself by the power of anthem that the body's disparate and selfish provinces are connected. And that's how the police found him, full-throated, dried blood on his white suit as if he'd been caught in a rust storm, song running back and forth along his hurt body like the action of a wave, which is not water, strictly speaking, but a force that water welcomes and displays. Driving alongside the Housatonic River alone on a rainy April night. I remember asking, where does my shadow go at night? I thought it went home. It grew so sleek at dusk. They said, you just don't notice it the way you don't tell yourself how to walk or hear a noise that doesn't stop. But one wrong wobble in the socket and inside the knee, chalk is falling. School is over. As if the ground were a rung suddenly gone from a ladder. The self, the shoulders bunched against the road's each bump, the penis with its stupid grin, the whole rank slum of cells collapses. I feel the steering wheel tug a little, testing. For as long as that takes, the car is a sack of kittens weighed down by stones. The headlights chase a dark ripple across some birch trunks. I know it's there, water hurrying over the shadow of water. In memory of the Utah stars, The Utah Stars were a professional basketball franchise in the American Basketball Association, itself now dead, and the Stars became a defunct professional sports team in the middle of a season some years ago. Each of them must have terrified his parents by being so big, obsessive, and exact so young, already gone and leaving, like a big tipper, that huge changeling's body in his place, the prince of bone spurs and bad knees. The year I first saw them play, Malone was a high school freshman, already too big for any bed, 14, a natural resource. You have to learn not to apologize, a form of vanity. You flare up in the lane, exotic anywhere else. You roll the ball off fingers twice as long as your girlfriend's. Great touch for a big man, says some jerk. Now they're defunct, and Moses Malone, boy wonder at 19, rises at 20 from the St. Louis bench, his pet of a body grown sullen as fast as it grew up. Something in you remembers every time the ball left your fingertips wrong, and nothing the ball can do in the air will change that. You watch it set, stupid moon, the way you watch yourself in a recurring dream. You never lose your touch or forget how taxed bodies go at the same pace they owe, how brutally well the universe works to be beautiful, how we metabolize loss as fast as we have to. In this poem, Unrelenting Flood, the great jazz pianist Art Tatum makes a cameo appearance. Black key, white key, no, that's wrong. It's all tactile. It's not the information of each struck key we love, but how the mind and leavened heart travel by information. Think how blind and near-blind pianists range along their keyboards by clambering over notes a sighted man would notice to leave out, by stringing it all on one longing, the way B-fingered, blind, mountainous Art Tatum did. The way we like joy to arrive. In such unrelenting flood, the only way we can describe it is by music or another beautiful abstraction, like the ray of sunlight in a child's drawing, running straight to a pig's ear, tethering us all to our star.
Live at the Village Vanguard. Near the end of Bill Evans's Porgy, I Loves You, Porgy, played live at the Village Vanguard and added as an extra track on Waltz for Debbie, a session made famous by the death of the trio's young bassist in a car crash, a woman laughs. There's been background babble bubbling up the whole set. You get used to the voices percolating at the song's fringes, the clink of glasses and chips of silver on hard plates. Listen to the recording enough, and you almost accept the oral clutter as another percussive trick the drummer pulls out, like brushes on a snare. But this woman's voice stands out for its carefree audacity, how it broadcasts the lovely, searching, lovely ascending stare of her happiness. Evans has just made one of his elegant, casual flights up an octave and rests on its landing, notes spilling from his left hand like sunlight, before coming back down into the tune's lush living room of a conclusion. The laugh begins softly, subsides, then lifts up to step over the bass line, five short bursts of pleasure pushed out of what can only be a long, lovely, tanned throat. Maybe Evans smiles to himself when he hears it, leaving a little space between the notes he's cobbled to close the song. Maybe the man she's with leans in, first to still her from the laugh he's just coaxed from her, then to caress the cascade of her hair that hangs lace curtain in the last vestiges of spotlight stippling the table.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks, Sebastian.
Little Evans there to...
Yeah.
I've been loving
the
music, man. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, what else would I bring? I thought about some work.
Yeah.
Too, but yeah.
And you another thing that you do so well in the memoir is you show your dad's love of music.
Yeah.
It's so... Yeah. Beautifully done all the way through.
Well, music was a big deal for him, and it's become a big deal for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, indeed.
Well, I know you're going to ask me to read some of my own poems.
That's right.
And I want to, but let's do a little bit more Bill Matthews, if you don't mind. And Kathy, there's a poem in Foreseeable Futures you were talking about. Maybe you can read that.
I would love to read this poem. It is a poem in Foreseeable Futures, and... I have to say that the first time I heard Bill Matthews read this poem, I did not know what a black box was.
Mm.
And now the poem especially resonates now in these last few years of all the airplane trauma that we've had. So every time I hear something about a black box, I think about this poem.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing Bill read it, and it's one of the most haunting poems I've ever read. So, Black Box. Because the cockpit, like the snowy village in a paperweight, parodies the undomed world outside, and because even a randomly composed society like Air Florida Flight Number 7 needs minutes for its meeting, the tape in the black box slithers and loops with its slow urinary hiss like the air filtering system in a fallout shelter. What's normally on the tape? Office life at 39,000 feet, radio sputter and blab, language on automatic pilot. Suppose the flight should fail, cosseted against impact and armored against fire, the black box records not time but history. Bad choice. The most frequent last word on the black box tape is mother. Will this change if we get more female pilots? Who knows? But here's the best exchange. We're going down. I know. Wow. That gives me goosebumps every time I read it.
Yeah. He's got a way with verbs, doesn't he? Cosseted.
Yes.
Indeed. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Indeed. Yeah. That's good.
Well, sorry.
Yeah. Sebastian, we need to hear from you.
Well, yeah, but before that, I'm here to pitch, you know, like a good son.
You found some new stuff, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I held it back for a long time, let's say that.
I see.
I created a certain Walt Disney-esque demand in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I found some other stuff, and I wanted to put together with Stan Plumley, but this was more my kind of baby, a kind of uncollected Matthews was the way I always thought of it, kind of like a mixtape, and do more of his wilder stuff, not so much his formal. Mm-hmm. He knew how to present himself as a poet really well through his books, but he also wrote all these recipes that he was proud of and stories that he were the kind of, you know, a poet's short story, but definitely short stories and kind of funkier essays that were for different purposes, an article on food for the New York Times. So I thought that would be really some of his one-liners, some of this, so a more full look at him as a writer. And the title of the book is called New Hope for the Dead, which is one of his one-liners, which I love. And truly, it is a bumper sticker that was done by the Alternative Press back in the 70s called New Hope for the Dead. And I have that bumper sticker, and I'm going to try to make them and then put them in the book so that people can get them.
Wow. That'd be good.
Because I just love that, New Hope for the Dead.
New Hope for the Dead.
Wow. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah.
And so this is an essay he wrote in the 70s, and I was thinking of that when I mistook the dates. But it's called The Poetry I Want. And he wrote it when he was probably, you know, his mid, almost, maybe approaching 30. Margaret Mead notes, it's called The Poetry I Want. Margaret Mead notes that primitive societies develop personalities the way some people do, by suppressing psychic white noise. That's why such a life seems simple. But the cost isn't invisible, it's only hidden. A heterodox, advanced society tends not to suppress anything. Quite literally, it will blow your mind. Good if your mind is a logjam or a penis. Bad if it's electronic equipment or brain cells. Also, all noises seem alike. Home sounds like Dallas, and me like what is possible for me. The poetry I want was raised somewhere else, like a feral child. You can't tell it how society works. It has no vocabulary. It has to develop, rather than to curse the inheritance of self-consciousness. It can learn from anything because it belongs to nobody, nothing, no model of society. It will be forced to choose its allegiance, an act, finally, of imagination. Logic helps, but you have to tell it what to do. This poetry will ask, where am I going to ground all this energy? In words, in the earth. I'll try to write such poems because I want to read them, but it doesn't matter where they're found.
Mm. Mm.
I think it's a pretty good little manifesto, you know.
And how old was he when he wrote this?
27, 28.
Yeah.
I hate that.
Saturn transit.
Yeah. He's a good essayist. He's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, log jam. And then I'm going to read one more poem of his, and it's called Dancing to Reggae Music, because I love it. And I definitely held this one back, because I wanted to put it somewhere else.
Somewhere perfect.
Which was fun. And I've rewritten half the lines. No, it's not true. Dancing to Reggae Music. The night with its close breath of sawdust and overproof rum, its clatter of waxy leaves above this scuff of earth we print and erase. The night pours over us its star-spotted syrup of wakefulness. I love the halt and stutter both in the lyrics with their exultant certainties about politics and religion. I want to disturb my neighbor because I'm feeling so right. Somebody lit a spliff. I can tell by the dense caramel of ganja smoke. There are traces of paying attention and trances of giving it up, which is where the blue-gray ganja smoke will go slowly. It's so thick and layered, and where the scent of dancing will go. A little acrid the way an armpit is after orgasm, as if acrid meant truculent to come back to our common life after the trances of the self we use each other for. How easy it is to dance about the self, and easy to confuse it with the constellate body. If they were the same, we couldn't move, much less dance the night away that's leaving us anyhow. It will go up, pushed back by the salt light of dawn coming from the ocean, and up is where we go from here after a detour through dust. So long, politics and religion. Hello, stars.
Ooh, oh.
Nice.
That's a great poem.
Nice.
Wow.
That is.
I like that
poem. That's very nice. Yeah.
Mm. Cool. Mm.
So that's going to be, when is that going to be out?
October from Red Hen Press.
October from Red Hen Press.
Very exciting. Yeah.
Good, good.
Well,
good.
I'm looking forward to the book and the bumper sticker.
Me yes. too. Yeah. Yeah. If I make it, you guys will get one.
I will have it on my car.
Oh, yeah. New Hope for the Dead.
New Hope for the Dead. It'll be on mine, too.
Saying it so, and actually in that mode, the book I'm working on right now of poems is called Miracle Day, and kind of like the I think it's an oxymoron. I think my dad would have liked that, Miracle Day.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of time, you know, or in terms of momentness,
right?
You know,
yeah.
So.
Well, we got to hear some Sebastian.
Yeah. Okay,
you going to share some of that?
I'd love to.
All right.
I've been writing poems lately. I call bragging poems. I thought my poetry was getting boring, so I thought I would start to try to raise the level of emotion. So. Excuse me while I brag a little bit.
Brag on.
Brag on. This first one, if I can find it, is called, it's a jazz poem, Mm-hmm. And I hate when people do this. Therefore, I hate myself. Nothing new. Eddie Locke's drum solo on Caravan, Alive at the Village Gate. There's a point somewhere in the middle of the desert of Locke's drum solo, say 4 minutes in, when you realize you've not only lost track of the melody, but could care less about melody, all song for that matter, fuck it, that for a while you've been inhabiting a lengthy sonic lecture on history, beginning with the original Malian rhythms and sticking on his way up past big band propulsion, looping back in long loping lines, jump rope skips, and large playground swings through time, Dolly's warp clocks, and the suspended water cat, holding back the all-star band from its last round of solos, moving way past decorum, playfully expanding the repertoire of moves and touches as a way to say, I can play it all, baby, and watch me do it.
Mm. Nice.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good, literally, it's like a 10-minute
yes.
drum solo.
I'm going to have to go dig that up. Yeah.
I'll give it to you. I have the old record if you want.
Oh, yeah.
You got to give it back, though.
Yeah, I will.
I know you will. You're on a radio station. You understand. Playing ball with Ross Gay. And Ross Gay is a poet, and he's a great poet, and he's a great basketball player. So this was a mistake.
And who's actually been on Wordplay.
Yeah. Playing ball with Ross Gay. People often say, you played ball with Ross Gay? Meaning, how'd it go, white boy? I say, numbskull, how'd you think? He dunked on my skinny white ass. But I don't tell him. But remind you now, Ross Gay, of that sweet little up and under, that old silky number I told you I could take you with. And you laughed with me, indulging me, shaking your head as I cut a quick jab step and dribble left my strong hand, and you were there, ready to block that shit, and the altered shot too, thank you. But then, body into body, I scoop under your sweep arm, knocking you off just enough. My underhand flick, granted safe passage, floats up, kisses off glass, and 2 points. And of course, I finish more like the old Rusty McHale I am. Creaky but crafty, bargain basement body, blue light special baby.
That's some good bragging. Bargain basement body.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
oh,
so that
wow.
was, yeah. I've yet to read that poem with him in the audience, and I might get hurt.
God. But that's delightful.
Yeah. That'd be fun. You have sent it to him, I hope.
Oh, yeah, actually, I tell the story. I sent him the poem when I wrote it, and he only had one edit because I cut a quick Pippin jab step, Scottie Pippin, and all he said was, Pippin. "Not Pippin."
Not.
I cut it. So, yeah. Okay, this poem is for a particular person who I will not name, though I do name at the bottom of the poem in the book. Critic song. Oh, petty assassin, tiny attack dog. I weather the fan of arrows you volley from the woods and pluck them out point by point. Gutter dropped as I go. Oh, master, no one, namer of the obvious, one who forgets the mask is there in hand, the one we use to mark the page. My body metabolizes your poison one barb at a time, converts it into bruised breath, breathes it out, dirty energy, even though, even so.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so now who's that for?
Just some guy.
Some guy.
This little tiny attack dog that
bit
my ankle.
Love it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So.
Yeah, what else you got?
Yeah. I'll read a couple new poems just to finish. I'll read a poem about Wolf Laurel that I just wrote.
Okay.
And a poem about Black Mountain College.
Cool.
And then one more.
Yeah, you've been actually associated with the college museum now for...
For a while.
A while.
Yeah.
Right.
Love that place.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Okay. So, this Wolf Laurel poem, I actually sent it to my friend Keith and made sure that he didn't tell me to throw it away, you know. But I was driving up, you know, that great drive back from down through Virginia and then coming back over 26. And I know how fraught that road 26 is historically, what it means to this place. But it's quite an amazing, you know, drop from Sam's Gap. And I was driving back from a long trip, and it's called For the Girl at the Gas Station, Wolf Laurel. The sign at the exit says Asheville one way, Johnson City another, meaning we're halfway between here and there. I say the day is perfect for driving around these mountains. You say, I wish someone would drive me around them. Of course, my heart swerves, both poet and divided soul, forever straddling my own county line, though you weren't soliciting. At 16, bone thin, as much boy as girl, you're pretty in a Shelley Duvall kind of way. Your face aches its own answer. No one will. You're too young to care. The highway just about stole the rock heart from this mountaintop county, who fought the cement carnival ride from design to sand. Quit the job. Slip out to the roadside and wait for the next young hot rod soul. Steer him to one of the rest stop vistas and let him take you in the tall grass. Better yet, steal his car and drive yourself up into those razor ridges. And once you get to Sam's Gap, all you have to do is point the thing down. The old mountains will applaud the length of their long and lovely vastness.
Oh, I love it. When is this book? When will we get to have it in our hands?
Oh, wow. That's 2012. I'm excited to have it done. You don't understand. This is another bragging poem. You don't understand how quick collage can be, how unthinking its moves and acts. You find what it means later and laugh at what you find or throw it a quizzical look. Attention to shape and color, space and story, what you're thinking, if thinking at all. Throwing a line out in the Gulf Stream, catching a current, not reeling in the prize fish. Up against somebody who knows some more about collage than anybody I know, and probably the least about collage I know. You know, like, so I was pissed. Okay, this is my last bragging poem, and then I'll read one more poem. Do I have time for two?
You do.
Okay. This is called Lines Composed While Washed Up on Shore. Where did I go? I can't say. The waters were dark and bitter. The plankton told stories of hidden texts dissolved in the waves. There was this lost hour when I became a cloud of blood, and the sharks sliced through me like bullets in slow motion. I do know that I dropped all ballast and floated free, though I won't say for an eternity. It's a cliche, meaning not true because it sounds so good, like a name tag placed on a whale. This part may have come in a dream, but a battalion of mermaids cast me as their private prisoner and took turns giving me salty mouth to mouth. I tried to embrace one but ripped my hands on her coral. Their breath wreathed out like seaweed. Really, there's not much to tell. Time passed. In my delirium, I asked you to come join me in the waves. It was a bad year. Okay, last poem, and it is... I wrote it for Alice Sebrill, actually, my friend and colleague at the Black Mountain College Museum, who knows so much about Black Mountain and cares about it so much.
Yeah, indeed.
And this is about also... Hazel Larson Archer, the amazing, I think, underrated photographer who did amazing photographs of Black Mountain College.
Even though she couldn't walk. And
she was this is a poem about her, about her being in a wheelchair. She had she had been afflicted with polio, and she was on her own in that scene with the wheelchair. A lot of people were helping her out, but she was tough. She was a student at this time, but she ended up teaching there. So she's and she also worked a lot of different things inside that group, so... I think she was a very important figure, and as usual, often one of the women in that group who didn't get until now some of the
way down the
awareness
road.
So Merce Cunningham, who died recently, the great dancer, Merce and Hazel, Black Mountain College, summer session, 1948. And one thing is that, as you guys know, 1948, the summer session was like the session. Everybody came. It was this incredible experience on the Lake Eden campus, and Merce Cunningham, you know, had started his troop there, and these are photographs I'm writing about that she took that summer of him dancing. And if you haven't seen them, go find them, because they're the most amazing photographs I've ever seen of dance. So it starts with the I Ching was always through Black Mountain. The more I study it, the more I realize, and the I Ching is kind of my Bible. So this comes from the I Ching, and it's a one-eyed man is able to see, a lame man is able to tread. Naming a lake Eden sort of raises the stakes, don't you think? Though, wasn't that the point at Black Mountain? where the men and women came ready to work. Rice's Socratic attacks on plasticity, Albers's to make open the eyes, and Olson all night ranting at the local tavern. Heaven above, the lake below. Picture Hazel in her wheelchair, camera in her lap. Someone's helped her to the field, or she's roughed the ruts on her own. Merce has begun his next course in soaring. Earthbound seer, airborne spirit, they inhabit reciprocal zones in the frame. Absolute stillness coupled with essential motion. But don't the eye and the finger flick, and the body and space come to momentary rest? Not standstill, but progress. In each new shot, Merce defies even our idea of gravity. He floats out of the frame, hang time galore, then drifts across the lens's ground, a balloon in his own parade. Hazel's in the middle of it all, the traffic of simple creativity swirling around her. At still center, the flag of her vision flaps on its pole, each unfurling clap a shutter click, each breath a hurling jump in the air. Off in the distance, out of the cropped frame, black mountains rise in an old staircase dance. The water on the lake makes its topographic music. Soon it'll be time for dinner and a much-needed break to reload.
Mm. What a lovely tribute to both her and Black Mountain College.
Yeah, thank you.
Wow.
I'm beginning to write poems about the summer of 48.
That's
exciting.
Yeah.
And that's going to be Wordplay for this week. Thanks so much once again to Kathy Smith Bowers and to Sebastian Matthews.
Thanks, Jeff. You rock, man.
So did Bill Matthews.
Indeed.